אתם עם SBS בעברית.
Alex Rifkin is the co-CEO of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry. He's also an author and commentator on anti-Semitism and Middle East affairs. He's been a leading voice on the rise of anti-Semitism globally and debates around the world on Israel and Gaza. Alex, welcome to SBS Hebrew.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
So we're coming off the back of these attacks in Manchester. The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and opposition leader Susan Lee have condemned the attack, with the Prime Minister saying there's no place for terrorism in our streets. What else should the government do to ensure communities feel safe? Should the government provide additional support as events are being organised to mark the 2 years since the October 7 attacks?
I think in terms of the immediate security, certainly the government needs to look at, you know, the advice of ASIO and the federal police and state police. They have their fingers on the pulse, as of course does the Jewish community and external security agencies as well. We're clearly in a place of unprecedented threat for the Jewish community, given everything that's transpired in the last 2 years, particularly with Iranian attacks on Australian soil, the role of organised crime, and of course the attack in Manchester, which reverberated throughout the world. But we can't live in a constant state of siege and crisis. We need to have immediate measures in place to secure the community, of course, but long term we need to move beyond this. And the blueprint is there. It was presented by the Special Envoy Julian Siegel back in July, a comprehensive plan to actually grapple with anti-Semitism in this country and deal with it in a fundamental way in all sectors of society, to deal with foreign interference and disinformation and social media and university campuses and education, all of these things which really need addressing. And unfortunately, it looks like it's still sitting on the shelf and hasn't been implemented.
Right. And some have suggested that Keir Starmer's support for Palestinian statehood may have emboldened these anti-Semitic actors, which contributed to attacks like this in Manchester just the other day. Do you see a connection between political rhetoric and the Israel-Palestine anti-Semitic behaviour that we see on the streets?
Look, I do. It can't, I think, be traced to one aspect, one part of the disinformation or the public statements that we see. But certainly there is a connection between the way that our government treats Israel and the way that Australians view Jews. I think that's something that the federal government here fails to understand. I think they draw a clear distinction between Israel and feel they can treat it as they see fit and attack it when appropriate and so forth, without necessarily damaging the condition of security and social cohesion with regards to the Australian Jewish community. But for most Australians, I think they draw a very clear connection between Israel and the Jewish community because it's so central to who we are, to our identity. And so when you see that sort of demonisation relentlessly, it does affect the community, no doubt.
Do you think that a lack of education could be at play as well?
I think education's a part of it, but we've been speaking about education for many years, and education is one of those things that drives out ignorance. And it helps, I think, kind of inoculate the well-meaning public against disinformation campaigns and the sort of conspiracy theories that are attached to the Jewish people. So there's certainly a place for it. There's no question. And I feel like there's been an awakening in the Jewish world over the last few years that we've invested so much in Holocaust education with good reason. But we've also realised that Holocaust education of itself doesn't address contemporary anti-Semitism. It places anti-Semitism as being something European and historic and solely of the far right. And so we need to really supplement that with education about anti-Semitism in the here and now, how it affects societies and communities right now. But education, as I said, is only a part of the puzzle. There have to be consequences. When people transgress, when people vilify the Jewish community, when they seek to boycott and exclude them and drive them from public view, there have to be social and employment and economic consequences and criminal consequences in some instances. And I don't feel like that's happening. And that sort of state of impunity is what is allowing things to get progressively worse and worse for the Jewish community.
What about outreach programs? Is there any positive evidence to suggest that interfaith outreach programs have benefit to promote social cohesion?
There's different types of outreach. So historically, organisations like mine as a peak roof body has engaged with counterpart organisations representing various Christian denominations and the Islamic community and various ethnic groups. But I think we're at a point now where that sort of leader-to-leader communication has limited effect. I think we're in a world now where you need more grassroots engagement. The power of communal leaders, particularly in some communities which are more diffuse and less organised than, say, the Jewish community, I think that by forming good relations with their leadership, their official leadership, you may have little impact on the masses of that community. So it's got to occur at a deeper level. It's got to occur at a more grassroots level. And I'm not sure the community's been good enough and proactive enough in achieving that. But there are, of course, a lot of good initiatives driven by the community, groups like Together for Humanity and Courage to Care, who go out to various communities and all parts of the country and expose them to the Jewish community and show them the richness and diversity of Jewish life. And I think that really is an important thing.
Alex, I want to bring it back to the UN General Assembly that was just on last week. Trump proposed the 20-point peace plan for Gaza. How do you assess it, and do you think it provides a realistic path forward?
I think it does, and obviously it falls short, I believe, of what the Netanyahu government wanted. There are certain things that it clearly had to concede on. Previously, the government had been talking about holding on to parts of the Gaza Strip for security reasons for the long term. The fringe, the far-right elements of the government were talking about depopulation and annexation, and Donald Trump was talking about those things as well. So the fact that this plan basically puts an end to that, any notion of those sorts of things, I think is very positive. It makes it clear that Gaza is for the Palestinians, but it also makes clear that Hamas can play no future role in it. It makes clear that it needs to be peacefully reconstructed, and the hostages have to be released immediately. Anyone who wants peace in the region would accept this plan immediately. You have a plan before you that ends the war, ends the suffering, allows unlimited aid to get to the people who need it, releases the hostages, puts an end to this war, an end to Hamas's stranglehold over the Gaza Strip and the lives of the people of Israel, particularly in the south. And I think the fact that so many facets of society who claim to be pro-peace or pro-Palestinian, they're dithering or outright rejecting this, I think it exposes them for what they are.
And of course, this plan had a lot of support from different Arab nations as well. So this really does put the spotlight on Hamas, which we're waiting for a response there. Alex, there's a lot of reports coming out of Israel saying that the army is tired, the country feels very tired. Do you foresee any wrap-up of this war? I know this is a bit of a pie-in-the-sky question, but just wanting to know what your thoughts are on that.
There's inevitably immense fatigue with this war. When you have a country that's so small like Israel, when you have the army made up predominantly of reservists, this is something which touches and concerns every Israeli. Every Israeli feels this so intimately. And that's before we even talk about what happened on October 7, the ongoing hostage crisis, the front in the north, issues with the Houthis, with Iran. No doubt Israelis are fatigued and they want to get back to their lives. They don't live in order to fight from battle to battle. They live to create, to produce things, to travel the world, to engage with people. The fighting has to be a means to an end. It can't be the end in itself. But at the same time, when you're fighting someone like Hamas that is fundamentally irrational, that will give up its own people for propaganda purposes, that will, on the one hand, claim a genocide and yet will wait days and days and days before even responding to ceasefire proposals, it makes it impossible. And I think, again, that's part of the Hamas strategy, because they know that in a democracy like Israel, the people will vent their frustrations at their elected government, even if it's not within their hands to actually deliver peace. It requires two parties to deliver peace and an end to war. So from their point of view, the longer this goes on, the better. But from Israel's point of view, the quicker this ends, the better. And I think we're all hoping that some good news will come from this plan. But again, when you're dealing with Hamas and understanding their calculus, we can't be overly optimistic.
And just before we finish, how do you feel about Trump's team that are working on this 20-point peace plan, like Jared Kushner, who's apparently back in the picture, and Steve Witkoff?
Obviously, these are people who take an unconventional path to diplomacy. But over the years, we've seen, you know, shuttle diplomacy under people like Dennis Ross and Martin Indyk have yielded very little, have elevated expectations and has resulted in more bloodshed and more disappointment. And ultimately, regardless of who is attempting to broker it, we have to look at the outcome and what they're producing. And the proposal on the table, regardless of who puts it forward, and I think this is part of the problem, some people are so inherently anti-Trump and anti-Netanyahu that anything they see as being favoured by them, they immediately view in a very hostile manner. But we need to get beyond who the mediators are and look at what's on the table. And on the table, you have a way to end this war and the misery and the suffering, bring the hostages home, and I really hope that both parties can accept this and move forward.
I know that was my last question that I asked for, but this really is my last question. Why do you think Arab leaders are so much more responsive to Trump's administration and his team? I mean, we're seeing material results really come up daisies from the, I mean, without sort of sugarcoating it, but we're seeing more movement within this administration now in terms of the actualities of a potential peace deal on the horizon. Why do you think Arabic leaders are responding much more positively?
On the one hand, they understand better than anybody, certainly anybody in the West, what Hamas represents and the danger that it poses, first and foremost, to the Middle East and the stability of Arab countries. So that's why any proposal like this, which sees the end of Hamas and the peaceful reconstruction of the Palestinian territories in a way that it poses no threat to the region, they would favour almost above anybody. But also, these are countries that are driven by primarily by self-interest and a desire for progress and economic development. And in Trump, they see a businessman, they see someone who can broker peace in unconventional ways, advance economic interests and enrichment, and they want to get on board for it. America is the sole superpower in the world. Donald Trump enjoys an almost imperial power and hold over sections of the world, and he's flexing that, he's showing that. And I think there's something seductive about power, particularly to those in the Middle East.
Alex Rifkin, thank you so much for joining us on SBS Hebrew.
Thank you so much.
רוצים לשמוע עוד סיפורים? האזינו דרך האפל פודקאסט, גוגל פודקאסט, ספוטיפיי, או בכל מקום אחר בו ניתן להאזין לפודקאסטים.